Coming up on Focus, I'm Jack Brighton, sitting in as your host, and today we'll talk about spam. The word spam conjures up several possible meanings, an often maligned but sometimes beloved canned meat product, an enduringly charming Monty Python sketch, but aren't they all? And finally, annoying email messages that flood the internet now at a rate of more than 120 billion every day. But spam is larger than a flood of email. Criminals have taken over huge numbers of computers worldwide to steal identities and credit card numbers, and to take over still more computers. Your computer might be doing more work than you know. Today on Focus, we'll look at what started all this spam and how it has become a kind of dark mirror of our networked world. Our guest will be Finn Brunson, professor at New York University. He's author of the book Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet, recently published by the MIT Press. We'll talk about that and take your questions by phone and email during this hour of Focus. But please don't spam us. Stay tuned. Good morning, I'm Jack Brighton, and welcome to Focus.
Morning.
Morning.
What you got then?
Well, there's egg and bacon, egg, sausage and bacon, egg and spam, egg, bacon and spam, egg, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, egg, spam, spam, bacon and spam, 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 baked beans, spam and spam, oh, lobster, thermidor, crevettes with mayonnaise sauce, garnished with truffle pate, brandy, and a fried egg on top, and spam.
Have you got anything without spam in it?
Well, spam, egg, sausage and spam.
Do you remember when you first got email? For me, one day they installed email on my computer at work, and it was like the electronic age of Aquarius or something. In a flash, I could exchange messages within seconds with people anywhere in the world. But soon, I began noticing strange email messages from people I did not know. Would I like to purchase some Viagra? How about a cheap mortgage or some mail enhancement? Soon, everyone with email was getting these strange offers. With those first spam messages, we quickly realized that this wonderful gift of email came with some interesting new annoyances. It's been years since that brief, blissful moment when we had email, but no spam. Today, more than 100 billion spam email messages are sent every day. But spam isn't just about email. There is comment spam, link spam, listserv spam, blog spam, phone spam, phishing spam, and now even my cell phone is getting text spam. How did this happen? Who is behind all this spam, and what is their motivation? Is spam an annoyance we just have to put up with, or is something larger at stake? Is there anything we, as citizens, consumers, and participants of the online world, can and should do about spam? During this hour of Focus, we'll talk about the history of spam as it has grown, along with the rise of the internet. Our guest is a scholar of computing and information studies at New York University. Finn Brunton is assistant professor in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at the Starnhardt School at NYU. He's also author of the book Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet, recently published by the MIT Press. In the book, Professor Brunton traces the development of computer networks and the internet and tells the story of spam's birth and evolution. We learn along the way about the freedoms and affordances offered by the information network world in which we are now immersed, and how those same freedoms are exploited in ways never intended by the internet founders. We'll put some faces to all the spam, and if we can't quite solve the spam problem during this hour, we'll at least give you some insight into how it works. As we talk with Finn Brunton, we invite you into the conversation. If you would like to call us, the phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us questions or comments by email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's welcome our guest, Finn Brunton. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, really appreciate your time. And I really enjoyed the book. I mean, who knew a book about spam could be an actual page-turner?
I'm delighted to hear that, especially because, yeah, for years while I was working on it, I sort of had a default answer to the inevitable question, which was, my God, why are you focusing on a subject like this? Like, it's so depressing and horrible and tawdry and so on.
Yeah, it's actually very fascinating. I have a bunch of questions, and we'll hopefully get questions from the audience as well. But let's cover the Monty Python thing right away. Did the use of the word spam as a phenomenon on computer networks indeed originate with a Monty Python sketch?
It did. It did. This is actually one of my favorite details that came up in the course of researching the book, because I was so curious about the etymology of this. There's a bunch of attempts that people made after the fact to sort of come up with clever, you know, acronymic meanings or whatever. But the fact is that if you go back to the earliest computer networks that were not just being used by professionals. So we're talking about moving into the 1970s. This is before the sort of formalization of the internet, and it's a period when the only people who really had access to networked computing were either sort of very very privileged, very technically savvy professionals in academia, the military, or certain areas of business, or graduate students.
Yeah.
And graduate students who are hanging out in the computer lab at 3 in the morning because it's the only time they can get online, like they're not just going to use it to, you know, share important Unix information or scholarly debate or something. They're going to quote song lyrics and make jokes and play games. And yeah, being the kind of total nerds who were spending 3 a.m. at the terminal in the computer lab, they all loved Python. And they started reenacting Monty Python skits in chat from university to university. And the spam skit was especially beloved because it had like a second effect that you could create. So normally when you're reenacting a skit, it's just kind of funny and people quote the lines back and forth at each other and whatever. With the spam skit, because of the lyrics and the dialogue that we heard in that little excerpt, you could write a fairly simple, you know, very simple program actually, that would just reproduce the word spam over and over again. So when the Vikings start singing or when the waitress is sort of going through that long list of things, you could just sit there and like enter the first few words and then just hit a key, initiate the program, and then suddenly the screen just fills with spam, like that word repeated over and over again. And because the bandwidth was so low and the technology was so constrained at that point, you could effectively shut down the whole conversation. You could pull this prank that would basically knock other people offline.
Yeah.
And sort of kill the discussion or kill their access to the system, is suddenly they just see like spam filling the screen faster than they can type anything in response, and it's pushing all the other discussion up off the top of the screen. And that's the moment where spamming develops its initial meaning, which is this idea of taking up more than your fair share of resources, dominating the conversation, doing this kind of dumb, prankish, kind of funny, kind of annoying thing that is sort of misusing other people's attention.
And those early networks were very limited in what they could do. So the actual resources that were being taken up by, you know, typing spam across the whole screen actually was very disruptive.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I actually, when I was sort of later in the process of working on the book, I tried to find an analog that could recreate for those of us online today what it was like to be on one of these networks. And the best I could find was actually trying to use the network connection on a satellite phone, but even that is better than what they had access to. It was so slow. If you were doing any kind of work remotely, the screen would just take longer to refresh than it took you to think. So if you were trying to make changes to a remote file or talk with someone else, you could type something in and then actually have to sit there and wait and see if you had like written a typo that you would then have to correct and so on. So even that small act was in some ways beginning to move out of just being prankish and into something that was actually like actively disruptive.
You frame the story of spam as a kind of technological drama, you know, where something is created to solve a particular set of problems, but then suddenly it opens up possibilities for other kinds of uses. And so people actually use it, and it kind of, you know, shifts back and forth in terms of the design and the use and how it plays out in the community.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the core of that's where I start from as someone who works a lot on the history of technology and the history of computing, that technologies are, you know, they're physical things and they have all these physical properties, but they're made by people and they're also arguments, and they contain embedded arguments about how things like wealth and power and status and access are distributed and how people should live, how people should use these things, how they should sort of interact with the world through these tools. And what you see when you follow the history of virtually any significant technology, is that it will be, you know, produced by a particular group who, along with, if they're making some kind of widget, you know, they want to make a profit, they want to produce shareholder value, what have you. Along with that, they're also kind of making statements about how this can be used, how people can live with it. And then when that technology gets out of the lab, off the workbench, out into the world, those statements often get reinterpreted. People figure out how to change things around, how to do things differently, how to make it serve their own ends in very different ways. William Gibson put this really simply and beautifully when he just said, the street finds its own uses for things.
That's brilliant. Well, so let's talk about the technological drama of the personal computer and computer networks. You know, it basically, the computer started out as you say it, a government machine. But this changed quite dramatically as sort of visionary countercultural hackers took over the cause.
It's one of my sort of favorite moments in not just the history of computing, but the whole history of technology generally, because it's just so astonishing to see. Like this thing, it's very hard for us to remember now how much, within living memory, within just the last few decades, really, computing was seen as the tool and the avatar of, you know, state power and overarching total control, and people were, you know, sabotaging mainframes during protests and burning those poor IBM punch cards, and sort of seeing computation as necessarily one aspect of producing what the great historian of technology, Lewis Mumford, called the mega machine, a sort of civilization scale system in which humans were just reduced to cogs operating inside the mechanism. And you can see this in the popular literature of the time, in movies, in sort of policy and political theory, all kinds of different things. And what's marvelous about that is the incredible, like, hairpin turn that it begins to take in the 1960s and 70s as people start producing what Stuart Brand from the Whole Earth catalog called counter-computing for the counterculture. All of these, it's such a marvelous turn of events. All of these people who were coming out of, in many cases, a more academic space rather than coming out of a more sort of military or business-oriented space, began to see these systems as having incredible possibilities for changing people's daily lives in ways that could be liberating and positive from their political perspective. And that's when you start seeing all these groups who are trying to sort of liberate computing. You see Ted Nelson, who coined the term hypertext, who described computers as like liberation machines, as dream machines. You had to learn how to use computers because they would enable you to think differently, to communicate freely with people all over the world, to pool expertise and knowledge in dramatically different ways. And this is where you start getting into the roots of Apple computing and the idea that you want a computer to be like an appliance, so it will be friendly to everyone. It will be immediately useful and apparent because that way you maximize the potential for liberation that the computer offers. I think a lot about this one particular moment where you can sort of see the two sides of what made computing what it is kind of meet, which is this guy, John Postel, who is a major figure in the history of the internet. He was sort of one of the sort of great visionary architects of the internet. And he managed the system of essentially addresses that made it possible on the early network for you to get from one computer to another and to tell when you were making a request from one machine that you were actually talking to it and not something else. Like, this was core work. But he was also this kind of classic California hippie dude with this giant flowing beard. And there's a marvelous moment when he was refused entry to an Air Force plane until he changed his sandals, which he wore year-round, for shoes. And he was going onto the plane so that he could do some work on an onboard sort of computing system that they had. But there's something about this image of this guy who is one of the most important people in the system that the military has helped to fund and build is then kind of actually encountering the military. And they're sort of like, wait a second, you're the guy? Like, you're this weird sort of sandal-wearing dude and we have to insist that you put on some actual shoes?
That's hilarious. Even more so because I'm actually wearing sandals today. But I'm no John Postel. Anyway, let me just reintroduce our guest real fast. We're talking with Finn Brunton. He's professor at New York University. We're discussing his book, Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet. We will carry on here. If you have questions, you can join us. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. 9455 by email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And also you can tweet us just simply at Focus580. I want to talk a little bit more about these early days. You're talking about, you know, within our living memory, these things just happened almost in a flash. There were the early computer networks. It wasn't really, there wasn't an internet per se as we know it. There wasn't one network. There were many networks.
Absolutely. Yeah, many networks with very different properties and very different sort of built-in rules. And this is kind of where the rubber meets the road a little bit in terms of the development of what we now think of as spam. Because they had done, the sort of early architects and designers had done a really extraordinary job of coming up with these very kind of robust protocols for moving information back and forth. But they had also never actually really thought through what the sort of social protocols should be, what the structures that govern how people interact with each other on these systems should be. So, you know, in the mid-1970s, the same guy, John Postel, he ran this sort of circulation of documents called the Requests for Comment. And this was the place where all of the architects kind of hashed out these ideas about how the system should run and so on. And he wrote a Request for Comment document that circulated through the group called On the Junk Mail Problem. And what he was describing was problems where a system on the network starts generating a whole lot of traffic, a whole lot of data, more than its share, and then it starts kind of dominating other connections, and you run into the same problem we were talking about earlier, where the system gets swamped, things go down. And his solution, it's a little heartbreaking to read now, because his solution is, well, just call the person who's in charge of the machine and tell them that they need to, you know, knock it off. They need to change how it works, because everyone on the network knew each other. There were just a couple hundred of them. They all, actually getting up towards, you know, more than a couple thousand at that point, but they all knew each other, and they were all sort of part of a fairly small family of not that many degrees of separation. And they all trusted each other, and trust was sort of the basis for a lot of these systems of authority. And that's where you start to hit this really strange moment where the network, the many networks, begin to spread outside of the boundaries where they had initially been established. And all of a sudden people have to ask, like, well, wait a second. We don't actually have any rules for how we're supposed to do this. We don't really know who's in charge here. Like, it's all very open-ended. There was never a need for that at first.
So there's a sort of a set of assumptions that everyone has without really discussing how they arrived at those assumptions. There are a couple of moments that you cite that I think are really interesting. One was on the ARPANET, which is a very early version of the internet and one of these networks I guess we're talking about. In 1971, a gentleman named Peter Boss sent a message to ARPANET that was basically an anti-war message. It was a very political statement. And this was not
exactly.
This became very controversial.
It did. Well, and actually, this is there's a small correction about that, but one that is sort of pertinent to this, which is that Peter Boss wasn't actually on ARPANET. He was on something called CTSS, which was MIT's in-house networking system. And it ended up bridging onto ARPANET and sort of being folded into it a little while later. But the reason I mentioned that, the reason it's significant, was that system existed so that all of these engineers and a few other users who were sort of scattered around could get access to the computing power that was available at MIT. And so they'd also built the system on top of it that let people who were on that system message each other through that computer. You could sort of send a message in to someone, and then when they checked in on the machine, they would get the message. And Peter Boss, who was one of the people who had worked on that messaging system, had this privilege, which was that he could, in fact, message everybody. And so that's the moment where he writes this, what became kind of an infamous or legendary message, which was titled, "There is no way to peace, peace is the way," which is a famous quote from the Christian pacifist activist A.J. Mustey. And he was reaching out to exactly the group of people who were going to be on the CTSS system, which was engineers who were mostly on defense contracts. You know, and this is the height of the Vietnam War. This is a year after the formation of the Union of Concerned Scientists. So you would think, like, wow, so there's this major political statement that's being made on this new communications format. Like, surely this was a huge legal deal or something like that. But precisely because it was CTSS, and it was essentially just an academic system that was being run by this really interesting computer scientist named Tom Van Vleck. Van Vleck could actually just tell Boss, like, hey, don't do that again. That was really irritating, and it, you know, sort of distracted everybody, and that's not what the system is for. So you can see this very early stage where the people who build the system, in some sense, are by default the people who have authority over it. And they can just say, like, look, that kind of speech is not acceptable here. Like, this is not a First Amendment issue. You just can't do it.
I want to fast forward just a little bit and talk about the history of the Usenet, which comes along a little bit later here, right?
Yes.
I remember the Usenet very clearly, and it was an incredible thing. By the time I got onto it, it was a global phenomenon. But could you talk about how the Usenet came about and what it was for?
Absolutely, yeah. No, and Usenet, it really is an amazing thing. I mean, it's the closest equivalent I can imagine to, you know, a bunch of guys who are like tinkering in their garage, like trying to build, I don't know, a radium clock, and then they accidentally produce an atomic bomb. Because it started out as one of the crucial things about ARPANET, which was this, the ARPA stands for Advanced Research Projects Agency. It was a sort of hybrid military academic project with overlaps in the business world. ARPANET was, in many ways, the place where they built a lot of the infrastructure and the concepts that became the internet. But a crucial thing about ARPANET was that it was really expensive to get on it. Only rich universities could afford to buy the kind of equipment that you needed to actually get onto the ARPANET system. But as ARPANET started to become more sort of, you know, legendary and infamous and interesting to people, these small groups of students who had these sort of big mainframe computers that were running Unix, the operating system Unix, were feeling left out. They were like, okay, so I go to a university that doesn't have a giant endowment and it doesn't have a huge Department of Defense contract, and so we can't play on the system, we can't do anything with it. So they built their own system, which is an extraordinary turn of events. And they built their own system so that they could write a message on their home computer, and then another computer at another university would check into theirs, copy the message over, and then the message would just sort of keep circulating around. And they built it so that they could talk with each other about Unix, about this operating system and about the programming that it sort of involves and so on. And then as they started to distribute the technology more widely and people started like building their own modems so that their computers could get onto this Unix network, this Usenet system, they basically, within a matter of years, they had sort of accidentally produced a worldwide, well, it was growing towards worldwide, network in which messages were freely exchanged across national borders, between universities. Essentially, anyone who could figure out how could get on. They had produced kind of a global society, and they had produced that global society with no formal rules, no formal oversight, no formal anything, because it was just people monkeying around with equipment.
Well, and you mentioned that, you know, trust, that word is such a key thing in this context. Usenet was really a community of communities of interest, in essence. But it seemed to share a value that, you know, the participants would respect the network and the relevance of posts to the areas that were sort of the threads or the different areas of the messaging system.
Exactly. This was the fundamental sort of demand of a system like Usenet, was that you respect the idea of salience. Because, and this is another thing that has kind of gone away, but believe me, was once a huge deal. Usenet was actually really expensive for different groups to run because they were having to pay the cost of the phone call to import the data from other computers when they were kind of copying messages from machine to machine. So what that meant in practice was that it was free for you sitting at your home university to write out your long screed about how, like, you know, the latest episode of Doctor Who has completely screwed up the whole franchise and you're sick of it all, and you write like 8,000 words about how angry you are about this. It's free for you to write that. It's free for you to post it. It's free for the people in your local calling area to read that message. But it costs $6 a minute in early 1980s dollars for a couple of people in Amsterdam to pull in the Usenet messages from a server in New Hampshire. And those minutes are going on and on and on as there's more and more of those messages. That's turning into some serious cash, and that's having to come out every night if they want to stay up to date with the conversation. So and what that means is that if you're posting a whole lot of irrelevant or off-topic material and they're trying to save a little money here and there by just subscribing to this or that particular conversation, this or that news group, then you're actually essentially costing them something by your desire to spread far and wide your dissatisfaction with Doctor Who.
So this is where we get into the territory of people, you know, literally spamming news groups, different sections of the Usenet that were, you know, devoted to particular topics with irrelevant posts, or maybe starting flame wars, or just, you know, being what we call a troll, essentially.
Absolutely. And this is actually where, if you don't mind me skipping ahead a little
sure.
bit further, this is where we hit the moment where spam, as we now know it, comes into being. Because we have this word has been kicking around for just ages at this point, but it's always been applied to people who are in one way or another disrespecting salience. It doesn't mean people trying to do like commercial speech or whatever, because that's actually okay as long as it's relevant at this point. It's fine if you're like in a thread about, you know, in a conversation on the system about whatever, you know, being a pilot, and you mention that you do flying lessons, what have you. That's okay because it's appropriate to the conversation. Spamming is people, you know, yeah, talking in conversations that are about something else, about something completely unrelated, or sort of telling dumb jokes, or sending out chain letters, or what have you. Now, in 1994, on this system that we've been discussing on the Usenet, that's actually when two lawyers realized, who are kind of relatively early adopters of a lot of these different networking services, suddenly realized that they actually have a huge audience here, that this is not just a community and discussion. This is a vast, untapped market. And it's a market that's spread all over the world. It includes a lot of like tech-savvy professionals in other countries, which means it's the perfect market for getting messages about basically buying legal assistance with visa and green card applications. So they get someone to write a script for them that posts 6,000 copies of this legendary message, Green Card Lottery, in which they provide their contact information, they talk about how you should get in touch with them, and they will help you get a green card through this sort of somewhat fraudulent mechanism. And with that moment, that's the moment where people are casting about for what to describe this as, this giant advertising barrage that has sort of completely skipped all the rules of salience, and even worse, has not done so in some like shameful way where it's like they're trying to hide out or they're pulling some kind of prank, but includes all their real contact information because it's marketing. They're looking for customers. And they realize that the only sort of good way to describe what's just happened here is spam. They have spammed Usenet. And this is the moment that spam starts to move off of the screen and into everyday life. This is when the New York Times starts using the word to not refer to the luncheon meat. It's when it sort of explodes. And these two lawyers are kind of the moment where it all begins to happen, not least because even though their message provokes a huge amount of outrage, it also provokes a huge amount of publicity. You know, they publish a book with a wonderful sort of 1990s title, How to Make a Fortune on the Information Superhighway. And they popularize the idea that that all of these different computer networks are actually completely unregulated zones for marketing.
I want to come back to that in a second. We have to take a very short break. Let me just say that we're talking this morning with Finn Burton. He's professor at New York University, and we're discussing his book, Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet. We'll be right back after this. This is Focus. I'm Jack Brighton, your host. We're talking about the history of spam and its impact with Finn Burton. He's a professor at New York University, author of the book we're discussing, Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet, recently published by MIT Press. If you'd like to join our conversation around Champaign-Urbana, the phone number 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. You can also send us email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or tweet us at Focus 580, at Focus 580. So there you go. Professor Brunton, I want to come back a little bit to this green card lottery thing. I actually remember that moment. I was on the Usenet at the time and really enjoyed it. I was into music and a variety of other things. And I saw this green card lottery message, and all of a sudden, you know, a great reaction to it. Obviously, you know, people were very upset about it. But the thing I wanted to ask you to talk about is this sort of clash of ideologies or sort of root paradigms that, you know, these two lawyers brought to this thing, because, you know, they didn't have the sort of, you know, hacker mentality that, you know, we all trust each other to maintain salience. And, you know, this is a tool for us to engage in community conversations about important topics. They saw it as a medium for advertising.
Absolutely, they did. And this is in many ways kind of the core moment that recurs repeatedly throughout the book, throughout the history of spam, which is a group of people who have actually been getting by perfectly well on what is famously called in sort of the world of internet architecture, rough consensus and running code. The technical system works, and we all are able to sort of get along and resolve things between ourselves. And therefore, we don't need some kind of elaborate governance system. We just need rough consensus and running code. And then the moment keeps happening again and again in various ways where spam occurs. Someone sends something, something is posted, something suddenly happens, and then all at once, a whole group of people have to say, okay, how do we stop this? Immediately followed by, wait a second, who is we? When we've just kind of been all sort of making this work, but who are we actually? Do we all in fact share the same ideas? Are we in the same country? Is that relevant at this point? So this is the moment where you can actually sort of see that communal invention and political invention has to start happening. Previously, even though by and large the network as we think of it now was the invention of and sort of paid for outright by the United States government and by various sort of subsidiary groups, it was something that had always had a really interesting post-national character. You know, as we've all experienced firsthand these days, national boundaries tend to dissolve really easily when you're on the internet. Like things, you know, things are just sort of coming from here or there. It's all just in this sort of same universal address space. And now for the first moment, there's this reassertion of that. People are suddenly like, okay, can we appeal to the police? Can we appeal to the U.S. Postmaster General? But they're assailed by counterarguments, which are, wait a second, why do we want to get the government involved in this? I mean, this is our kind of free space. What if we're actually building something new here, something that's never quite existed in the world before, this kind of anarchist, post-national gathering of people who are all kind of sharing common interests and who can collectively resolve their own disputes? Why are we trying to, like, make the FCC feel like it needs to regulate this thing? And, you know, honestly, that dispute has pretty much been going on ever since. But there is, it's one of the things that I think was really useful about looking at this was also to remember in our sort of current moment of talking about the government having a kill switch for the entire network and talking about you know, really quite centralized systems that are under the fairly direct control of various branches of the state, that there was a time when it seemed like this technology was presaging a new and very different kind of order, a communal order. And one of the things that kind of shook up that sense that that's where things were headed was spam.
There are a whole bunch of great stories that go along with this. Right after the green card lottery, you know, speaking of cultural, you know, sort of shock or sheer, however we want to, you know, define it, AOL connected up with the Usenet just right after that. And that brought a whole bunch of people who didn't share that sort of same, you know, sort of countercultural or idealistic view of the use of this network.
Absolutely. Well, and that is the other thing. It's like a lot of this sort of rough consensus and running code stuff was based on the fact that there was a kind of like time equity, a sweat equity that you put into being able to be on the network with other people for all of these different kinds of networks, which was that you had to kind of be a newbie for a while and people would treat you differently. And then you'd start to sort of get a sense of how everything works. You'd learn what the rules were. You'd sort of lurk without posting for a while and you'd sort of get a feel for how things are done. And then you kind of have that sense of the rough consensus and then you can really participate. But of course, it's one thing for that to sort of slowly evolve among a group of people who are building a new technology. It's very different to ask people who are like paying a monthly subscription fee for access and then be like, no, you can't do anything yet. Hang around for a year or two. Listen to us argue. Go read all these long documents where we talk about etiquette and where we sort of evolve all of these different approaches and then abide by them, even though no one's actually told you you have to. It's just something you need to do for this to keep working. Very few people are that amenable to that, you know, like especially if they're actually paying for access. And that was honestly the really depressing thing about the green card lottery spam. Wasn't just that it happened, but then after it happened and they started, the two lawyers started publishing material about it and writing about it and being very public about it, one of their core statements was there aren't actually any rules or laws governing this. There's this kind of idea that all of these nerds have who have built this system that this is how we're supposed to act, but none of those rules are in fact binding. Like the Constitution, the legal infrastructure, that's binding. None of this stuff actually matters. And this was the whole basis on which these systems had kind of grown and evolved to operate. So the people from AOL, when they were suddenly dumped into Usenet, did not take kindly to showing up in this space that just seemed to be another part of the computer network that they were, you know, paying money to be a part of, and then suddenly being just like castigated by these old timers who were like, no, you don't understand. We can only have conversations like this in this particular, and so on and so forth. You could already see that there was a deep clash about how we were to use this system and what sort of rules we were supposed to follow.
At least read the darn fact, right?
yes, no, exactly.
Well, I want to shift to so now we get the rise of this industry around, you know, this commercial use of the network. Because now it's global and you've got, you know, not just a few thousand people, but a few hundred thousand and now millions of people on these networks. And entrepreneurs sprang up to make money on a variety of spam-related activities. You tell the story of Rodana Garst and her company Premier Services, which I think is just really an interesting insight into what, you know, this clash was all about for the people who saw it as an opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, then there were, like, one of the things that I try to distinguish, it's so odd, like, to make this book work, it's not that I had to in any way sort of sympathize with the work of spamming, but you have to try to sort of see the world from their perspective, if only so the book isn't just like a nonstop angry polemic.
Yeah.
And it was really fascinating to get into the space of spamming as a business, which has changed, you know, quite dramatically over the course since this moment of its birth in 94. Because you can see that there's actually really a spectrum. The spectrum runs all the way from people who are doing just straight-out fraud and pursuing it by any means that are available to them and who are completely comfortable being criminals and who are in many cases coming from some other area of criminality. But then there's a whole other domain, which is people who came out of there's a lot of dicey marketing. Especially in the United States, there's a lot of legal gray areas around direct mailing, around claims that you can make in printed advertisements, around telemarketing, all those kinds of things. And there were a lot of people who were already working in that space who suddenly saw like something that was even less regulated than that was, where it was entirely possible to just sort of buy some equipment, buy some software, get it all set up in your basement, get an understanding internet service provider who will look the other way when you start getting complaints, and then you can actually start making some really serious money. And there really isn't anyone who will sort of tell you otherwise. And ultimately, a lot of these people do end up tripping up, especially as they try to move into more lucrative areas. So like in the case of Garst, she'd started out, you know, kind of pushing ads for all kinds of things, mortgages and sort of like, you know, dead stock toys and all kinds of stuff. But then after a while, she starts to move into something that pays really well, which is stock touting. You know, these are the spam that people still get all the time. They're still very common. I just got a couple this morning that are like, you know, this stock is about to move. Like, you know, small-time investors can take advantage of this, blah, blah, blah. And the problem with that is once you start doing that, especially if you're trading in stock yourself, it starts to look a lot like deliberate manipulation, like insider trading, essentially. And yeah, a lot of those people, including Garst, ended up being busted by the SEC. But again, they weren't busted on the basis of being spammers, at least at first, because again, there really wasn't any kind of regulatory system in place.
Another gambit that I think most people who have email will be familiar with is the Nigerian Prince scam, or as I think it's officially called, the 419 scam. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about the sort of origin of that and what that's all about.
There was more about that than I could put into the book. It's such an amazing thing because that is a con so classic that so far the earliest instance that I found of it actually dates back to the French Revolution. But it's got a very simple structure that works extraordinarily well, and which I'm sure kind of everyone will recognize, although it's sort of easy to miss under all the kind of bizarre texture of the stories of, you know, embezzled money that's been plastered in the walls of a house in Lagos or whatever, which is at heart the come on of I have some kind of really significant asset. I need help getting that asset out. I'll give you a cut of it. And in return, I just need a small initial investment. It's this promise of investment for return. And it's been going on for ages. It went on primarily through postal networks. I found wonderful, depressing, but still kind of fascinating, accounts of it, firsthand accounts from the turn of the century, from the New York Times, when there was a major syndicate doing this kind of thing. The countries change. The choice of country is really interesting. It's always a place that is just far enough away that the victims will not have a really good grasp on, you know, what it's actually like or what the sort of system is for actually moving money from place to place. It will seem plausibly chaotic. You know, there's usually some kind of uprising or unrest or chaos happening there. In the turn of the century, it was in Cuba and Spain, you know, Spanish-American War stuff. All of these places where you can invent a story and then you can sort of rely on, like, movies and cop shows to kind of fill in the rest of the reader's imagination for what things are like and for how it actually works and how they can potentially make money off of it. And it's very lucrative. You know, the rate of return is not good. It isn't good for anything in spam. But if you can do it successfully, it's shocking the amount of money that you can steal from people.
We're talking with Finn Brunton, professor at New York University, about his book, Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet. We have a caller we'll include in our conversation. And time for others, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a caller in Champaign County.
Hi. This isn't directly about spam, but you were talking about the culture of the Internet and the way it was changing. What do you have anything to say about network solutions in 93, the Clinton administration, and apparently they were happy to call it the year of privatization too, turned over domain name registering. It was overturned by an international group a few years later, but network solutions is kind of a shady outfit, and I don't know if anybody's chronicled it. I found just a little reference to it in a book on intelligence outsourcing, curiously enough, but Do you know anything about that, Chester?
I do, actually, and that's something that I think really kind of gets that particular moment actually really gets to the heart of one of these issues, which is, you know, who owns the Internet, who controls it, and how is that control sort of distributed? Like, we sometimes think of it as being something free, and we sometimes think of it as being something that's kind of, you know, very explicitly owned or controlled by particular groups. But yeah, so to jump to a contemporary sort of event, you might remember, like, the moment when in the middle of the whole kind of Cablegate scandal around WikiLeaks, they actually successfully got WikiLeaks, the domain name, de-addressed. So you would type it into your address bar, and then it wouldn't actually lead you to the site. You had to actually type in the digits that were the specific address of where WikiLeaks, where all that data lived on the server, on the Internet, to actually get there. And that captures exactly what you're touching on, which was, it's really important to know that the addresses are going where we think they're going. And that's something that a very deliberate decision was made in the 1990s to shift away from being under the control of the architects of the Internet itself and shift it into something that was going to be part of private business, part of, to a lesser degree, international policy. And it's that was one of the instances where the whole character of the Internet really changed dramatically. There's a famous event which is chronicled in a wonderful book, which I really recommend, called Ruling the Root, which studies this moment when the same guy that we've talked about earlier, John Postel, who was in charge of the addressing system at that stage, deliberately altered which computers all addressing systems would refer to into computers that were under his control and under the control of people that he knew. And it was this kind of really weird moment because he was notionally doing it just as a test or as an experiment, but the general consensus is that he was also doing it because he was outraged by the Clinton administration wanting to introduce .com and basically start saying that commerce was now going to be a default part of the network. The Internet was now about being an engine for business. And he and many of the other people who had worked on the network very early were infuriated by this and felt that control was being taken away from them and this sort of incredible system that they had developed was about to be sort of turned into something very different, into a marketplace. And there's a particular moment where he tries to shift control of the addressing system to his own stuff. He does it successfully, and then Ira Magaziner actually calls him up and is like, "What in God's name are you doing? Like, this belongs to us now. This is not something that you guys can treat like this kind of toy." And you can see where the value of that begins to shift.
Very interesting. Well, there's so much that I'd love to cover. We have just about 6 minutes left, and we will be able to only scratch the surface, really, of all the stories that are in the book. I wanted to make sure that we talk about what has happened sort of since these early days of spam and the rise of the Internet itself and sort of, you know, the efforts to combat spam, whether by software means or legislation and so forth, had, you know, unintended consequences, shall we say, of sort of consolidating the spam industry into the hands of some very bad actors who are doing now increasingly, you know, very dangerous things that affect us all, really.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, and this is kind of the last third of the book, and you're absolutely right. So just to kind of skip ahead again, but touching on the root domain name thing, getting into this still in the space of political changes to the network. In the early 2000s is when the whole spam problem really starts to get addressed, and it gets addressed in two ways. And one is really good filtering systems start to be implemented, and the other is political legislation with real teeth, especially in the United States, but also all around the world. And what that does is it effectively wipes out a huge part of the population of spammers who are these kind of small-time entrepreneurs, like the sort of people who used to like advertise in weightlifting magazines or whatever, and who kind of took to this. It wipes those people away. And the people who are left are outright criminals, but also much more technologically sophisticated than the majority of the spam population. And these are the people who build the botnets. And these are the systems that are really in play now. And the botnets are made up, as you alluded to at the opening of the show, of ordinary people's computers, which have been infected with various kinds of malware, which make the computers into something that are kind of sending spam without the user actually realizing that they're doing it. And with control of a botnet, you can send a huge volume of spam on the order of billions of messages from all over the world, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And once those systems are in place, and that's kind of where we're at right now, yeah, spam starts to turn into kind of a military problem. It starts to turn into something where you can do denial of service attacks, where you can swamp remote machines, or where you can also have infected machines and you can then scrub them for sensitive information that you want to like resell or use in other ways.
So people stealing credit cards and identities, actually, whole identities of people.
I was on IRC channels that were devoted to this kind of trade, and it was absolutely freaky. Like, you know, just sort of straight up people being like, okay, I got social security numbers, I got dossiers, I got healthcare information about, you know, person X, person Y. And that's potentially an enormous amount of revenue for someone who's willing to go to the trouble of doing really serious identity theft.
See, this is something that I think a lot of people who use the Internet and use computers don't necessarily, realize. They don't see this, you know, they haven't sort of the technical background to see this happening. But, you know, these things have become massive operations that, in fact, you mentioned that the biggest challenge for the botnets is really other botnets trying to knock them off and take over the machines they've infected.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, almost every botnet installation sort of software system, so the stuff that someone like doesn't realize that they're downloading that ends up infecting their computer, also includes a suite of programs that are designed to search for and remove other botnet control systems that already exist there.
It's amazing. And if you have a botnet, you have a variety of ways to make money from it. You can actually rent it out to other people for a variety of purposes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can sort of, they have, you know, many of the most sophisticated botnets now are essentially partitioned. So you can just sort of give some, you can say, you can offer in one of these marketplaces, you know, hey, okay, anyone who wants access to 15,000 computers, all on broadband connections, can send X amount of spam per day. This is how much it will cost you to rent. There's actually a great criminologist who's based in Indiana who's done a lot of research on Russian spam markets and botnet markets. And among other amazing details that he found, along with the fact that it's shockingly cheap to send, say, 100 million messages, he also found something which just delighted me, which is that some of the ones that are based in the same city will actually close a deal with a congratulatory bottle of champagne. It's such a little genteel note for this giant criminal marketplace.
That's simply amazing. Well, one of the things that I noted is the language that you use in describing this stuff. There's a quote that I really love from your book, which is, "Spam persists and diversifies because we are living through a major complex transition in the constitution and management of our own attention, a transition moving faster than our governance, our metaphors, and our software can keep up with." Metaphors?
Yeah, well, I think metaphors are actually very powerful. Like one of the things that really fascinated me about the early response to spam was that people were groping around for ways to describe what the network was like so they could define how spam was a violation of it. So they were trying to say, okay, it's like a public space. Well, except it isn't really, because public spaces have laws, so it's sort of like a consensus system. It's like we've rented out a conference hall. Like they're really kind of struggling to come up with ways to metaphorize something because, and I mean this very literally, when you can metaphorize something abstract into a way that we can actually think about it concretely, you can also start to come up with strategies that let us get to grips with those things, that let us come up with technical solutions, social solutions, legal solutions to those problems.
Well, we're going to have to stop, unfortunately. We've scratched the surface. The book is Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet. The author, Finn Brunton, B-R-U-N-T-O-N, professor at New York University. I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me. This has been a complete delight.